This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. One of the things to come from last year's shooting of Keith Lamont Scott was the new resolve to address one element of the growing challenge posed by economic inequity, the lack of affordable housing. Charlotte City Council set an ambitious goal for itself. They decided to create 5,000 affordable housing units in just 3 instead of 5 years. But the headwinds toward that goal are considerable. First, housing prices in Charlotte continue to rise. Rents are rising, too. Second, developers are racing to fill demand for new homes in close-in neighborhoods, and that is displacing many longtime residents in low-income neighborhoods, further reducing the stock of affordable or workforce housing. And now the biggest source of funding for affordable housing projects may soon dry up. Well, yesterday afternoon, Charlotte City Council held a special meeting to talk about the progress being made toward their goal and the strategies in place to making that achieving that goal a possibility. And this hour we hear from 2 council members about what they heard yesterday, the challenges ahead, and where we stand. Luana Mayfield represents District 3 on council and chairs that body's Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
You're welcome. Ed Driggs is here. He represents District 7 and is vice chair of the Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee. Thank you for joining us again.
Good morning, Mike.
And we're also joined by Eli Portillo, who covers all of this for the Charlotte Observer. And welcome back, Eli.
Thank you.
And as I said, there was a meeting yesterday afternoon, which you reported on and filed a story, and it was in the paper. And there was a surprise at that meeting. Talk about that.
Well, I think the finding that the consultants the city has engaged to study this problem came up with that really surprised some folks was how concentrated the need for affordable housing is with people at the very lowest end of the income scale. When you talk about affordable housing, there are a lot of different acronyms that get thrown around. One of them is AMI. That means the area's median income. Half the people make more, half the people make less. The need for affordable housing for people making less than half of the area's median income is about 21,000 units. For people who are making 80% of the area's median income, that might be your nurses, teachers, those sort of lower paid but professional jobs. The consultants found that there actually isn't a great need for affordable housing. Based on the market, there's actually a somewhat oversupply of housing units that those people can afford.
And correct me if I'm wrong, because what I took out of that article that you wrote this morning was also the fact I've never seen workforce and affordable housing split into 2 categories, where affordable housing would be for those people below that median, half of the median income, and workforce housing would be for teachers, fire people, police officers, etc. I'd never seen the two broken out. I thought they were synonymous.
Right, and that's one of the problems that comes up in this issue is there are so many different buzzwords and terms, and sometimes when people say affordable housing, they think subsidized, they think Section 8. Sometimes when people say affordable housing, they mean workforce housing, which is technically for people making around 80% of the area's median income. That might be your teachers, nurses, folks making in the, say, $42,000, $45,000 range.
What is the median income in Charlotte?
In Mecklenburg County, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $56,000 a year.
So less than half of that would be, what, 20, 30? 29,
yeah, somewhere
30?
In that. Yeah, say 28 and below.
And that's for a family, not for a single person, I take it.
Well, there are a lot of numbers here, and they change based on family size, where exactly you are in the country. So these are all ballpark figures.
So you're saying that people who make $30,000 or less are in the need of affordable housing, meaning what? Explain this to me. I mean, 30% of your income, no more than 30% of your income should go to housing. Is that right?
Right. So the standard benchmark is that you shouldn't spend more than 30% of your income on housing. And that includes rent, utilities, those kind of things you have to pay for.
Right.
So take someone who is making a little bit more than minimum wage, say $16,000, $16,800. That's 30% of the area's median income. That might be a food service worker, a part-time retail employee, someone in that category. Under the 30% affordability benchmark, they would only have around $400 a month to spend on housing.
Wow.
And meet that affordability benchmark. Now, there are not a lot of unsubsidized housing options in Charlotte. You can probably count them on one hand for people to spend less than $400 a month on, and they are generally substandard.
So, Luana, this the city's had a long focus on doing something about this and has had a program in place and funding in place to find affordable housing or to create affordable housing or to maintain the stock of affordable housing and workforce housing. But you really focused, you began to really focus or change your focus or laser focus after the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott. Why? Why was that the trigger?
Well,
no pun intended.
Right. I want to challenge that a little bit. Your council, especially your Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee, we had already identified that we had a goal of 3,000 of within 5 years, 5,000 units. Then after the unfortunate events and we lost the life of a young man in our city, what the conversation then became is, can we accelerate this? Is there a way through our dollars and through our partnerships so we accelerate it?
But why
that
the connection? What was it about Keith Lamont Scott and the loss of his life and suddenly this desire to focus in on affordable housing?
See, that's where I'm going to push back a little bit. It wasn't the fact that that was the trigger. We as a council recognized that the community was hurting and we were trying to figure out what is the best way through our limitations on the city to advance what we've already known. We've known in the community for many years that people were being priced out of housing. We've known and seen for many years where new developments come in and you have less than 20% of the current residents that live there that were able to pay $400 or $500 a month are displaced and a very small percentage get to come back. So it wasn't the fact that the shooting triggered us to do more. We were doing it, mm-hmm. but we recognize we have an ability to accelerate it. And the community has said, you know what? We want you to do something. We want it done yesterday. And you finally had a council in place that recognized that as a committee, we can come together and we can move it forward.
Ed Riggs.
Yes, I just wanted to point out, Mike, after the shooting, there was a lot of unrest in Charlotte. People right. were in the streets. We had the whole Ferguson thing going on. And what the council recognized was that there were deeper-rooted problems that were behind that unrest. So we got together and we thought about what can we do to be responsive. And we passed a community action plan. We issued a letter to the community and we said we're going to focus on three areas to help alleviate the problems of the people at this level. So the connection is just that the shooting caused an outpouring of anger okay. from certain people. And we decided that focusing on how we police in so law enforcement, on housing and on job creation would be our best response to that to help address those issues.
Yeah, in that letter you said, we recognize that there are some people who enjoy relative wealth, prosperity, and opportunity, while others struggle to find good-paying jobs, affordable housing, and some may not trust law enforcement. You wanted to jump in on this, Eli?
Yes. Actually, after the council's briefing yesterday, there was a meeting of affordable housing advocates and many of the protesters from last year, from the Charlotte Uprising Group, for example. And they held a meeting out front in front of the government center and said that they are still focused on affordable housing. And they made the connection very explicitly. They said, people aren't just angry about policing. We feel that our communities are being displaced and we don't have a voice. Mm-hmm. And we are still watching Charlotte City Council and still engaged on this issue. And this was, you know, the people in many cases who were the same protest leaders from last year saying this is one of the root causes why that match of the Keith Lamont Scott shooting set off this fire.
But something else came out of yesterday's meeting that was rather surprising, given the fact that I wrote the opening before the meeting. as of August 15th, the number of affordable housing units, I believe, is 2,219.
Correct.
That's 44% complete, which means you are actually ahead of where you plan to be at the end of 3 years, 5 years? No, yes?
The three-year term starts at the beginning of 2016, so we're a year and a half in, and we weren't quite halfway there. We're slightly behind, but the thing we did yesterday would put us ahead.
Well, really, after September, we accelerated the three-year in January of this year, because remember, it was after September that all the events happened, mm-hmm. where we initially had 5 years. 5,000 units. So in January of this year, that's what we're counting for that 5,000 goal in 3 years. So if you look at the fact that we are at 44% and we are only in August, And if you go back and look at what your Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee moved out of our committee last Wednesday, which is completely outside the box and in the history of the Housing Trust Fund, between five projects, what we're sending to full council is the request of an allocation of almost $21 million, which is really unprecedented, but it shows the community, because a number of us, including myself, feel that before we come to the community and say we need more trust fund dollars in our bond, because we've been asking for $15 million for years before we asked for $30 million, you need to see how we can invest the monies that we currently have. Because a lot of people feel like, well, you've had the money, why haven't you spent it? They hadn't realized some of the limitations. So we basically unlocked a tax credit line that we hadn't used before. So this is funds that the city has said, when we move this, if full council approves these recommendations for these five different developments, this is money that is guaranteed to help towards those developments. And that's going to create 749 additional units.
So there's a mayor's race going on. Perhaps you've heard about it.
yeah.
One of the Republicans running for mayor, Gary Dunn, has said he doesn't believe the city should be in the housing business. He says, you want to house everybody cheaply? Really? Are we Howard Johnson's? Are we Marriott? Well, aside from the fact that Howard Johnson's are pretty hard to find these days, and the Marriott ain't cheap, How do you respond to that?
I think, Mike, that we have to recognize that we need to invest in the social health of our community. So this housing situation has created a bifurcation of the population, a polarization, which you can see in our schools, for example, and the segregation of the schools. And I think there's a burden on all of us to make Charlotte a more livable place. I think everybody benefits from the fact that it's a happy community and that we don't have riots in the streets. So I have advocated for an investment. I want to make sure we invest efficiently and wisely and that we get productive results, but I don't think we can ignore the problem.
But he says, Mr. Dunn says, that the city shouldn't do anything because low-income people commute. Just because they commute so that they can live in the cheap seats, those are his words, out of town where it's affordable. He says, we've been so successful that there is no affordable housing downtown anymore. In other words, the city's growing so quickly, everybody wants to come here, everybody's being priced out, that's a good thing. But the other side of that, according to what I've learned from talking to experts about this, is that school teachers, and this is workforce housing now, school teachers and firefighters and people like that, are also making long commutes, and we don't have sufficient convenient mass transit. So which is cheaper, building out mass transit or building affordable and workforce housing?
That's a very good question, because we do have to look at the trade-offs. It's not just a money question. People spend hours traveling back and forth to work, and that impacts the well-being of the community as well as the availability of a particular kind of housing. If you can shorten a commute, you've effectively created a more efficient connectivity, better access to jobs. So I think we need to look at the system as a whole. We have a very ambitious transportation plan for Charlotte that goes out 20 or 30 years involving investment of about $6 billion in mass transit. That has to be coordinated with our housing policy so that people can live where the transportation is and get where they need to go.
And I think it's not a conversation of either or. It's definitely an and conversation. So I definitely support and am going to say ditto to my colleague, Mr. Driggs, because we have to change the conversation. And the idea of someone thinking that government doesn't have a role, I will be challenged to vote for that individual.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more about affordable housing and specifically the Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee and their recommendations and some of the things they reported on last night. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Barnstock Music Festival, using music to support local nonprofits and charities dedicated to protecting the environment, educating children, and feeding the hungry. Founded in 2009, more at mybarnstock.com. And Grandfather Mountain. Grandfather Mountain is a scenic nature preserve located off the Blue Ridge Parkway, offering picnicking, a museum, and more. Grandfather.com. With the recent rally in Charlottesville, fringe groups have come out into the light, specifically racist nationalist groups. They've been around for a long time, existing on the periphery of society and in the dark corners of the internet, but now they feel the time is right to make their presence known. Experts say that news coverage could inspire more to join, but why would someone join what we commonly think of as a hate group? We get some perspective on that tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Coming up on the next On Point, underwater. Devastating floods in Texas put the spotlight back on the nation's troubled flood insurance program. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks. Here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE. Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about affordable housing and the need for it in Charlotte and what's being done to try to make the supply equal the demand. Luana Mayfield is here, District 3 council person, along with Ed Riggs, District 7. They're chair and vice chair of the Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee for Charlotte City Council. Eli Portillo is also with us from the Charlotte Observer, who reports on this regularly. I don't want to leave the other Republican, one of the other Republicans in the race, out of this comment section about affordable housing. Kenny Smith is another candidate. And he's also on city council, and he talks frequently about the lack of affordable, privately financed housing and the fact that it's costing taxpayers millions. What is privately financed affordable housing? What is that, Eli?
Well, there are several different categories that fit into this mosaic, and most of them, a lot of them are privately owned. There's an acronym I learned recently called NOAA, which stands for Naturally Occurring Affordable Housing. And that basically means older buildings that have become affordable because they're old. They're from the 60s and 70s, and the rents are naturally in that, you know, $600, $700 range that a lot more people can afford. Most of the new housing that's being built is funded by private developers. Mm-hmm. They often, if they're building affordable housing, will receive some kind of subsidy, like this housing trust fund dollars that we're talking about, which provides gap financing for those. But they're being built by private companies with some city assistance. I think what this gets to, though, is sort of what was discussed yesterday. If you are making, say, $12,000 a year in Social Security disability income payments, that puts your rent that you can pay and stay at the affordability benchmarks somewhere around $300 a month. Mm. There's not really a business case I've seen that would support building privately owned and operated unsubsidized housing for $300 a month.
Can you rehab it? Can you keep people who have older structures?
Can you keep them
in the rental business, mm-hmm. and can they make money and sustain that even on an older property? Because you still have to do maintenance.
There are some cities that have done more with that in terms of providing financing or even buying properties before they're redeveloped. But all of that takes a lot more money. Uh-huh. And the essential math problem here is that if we're talking about needing 21,000 housing units for people who can pay $300, $400 a month, it's very difficult to get there without someone spending a lot more money.
Ed.
Most of the oversupply in the bracket above 50% is, in fact, privately funded, meaning it's market-priced housing. It just happens to be low-priced housing. The problem with that, though, is you don't have anything in the deed that caps that so that you know that in the future it can't become unaffordable, that gentrification or whatever can't make it inaccessible. So we're still looking at that segment in terms of trying to guarantee the supply in the future.
And that's partly where this land trust idea comes in that Kenny Smith has talked about. He says that land is expensive, and that's one of the primary obstacles, and that maybe we should investigate creating a land trust. And this came up yesterday afternoon at your meeting. Councilmember Julie Eisel asked the consultant Chris Kissel of Enterprise Community Advisors about whether land trusts in fact can work.
It seems like we have separate conversations about preservation than we do about creating affordable housing. And so I'm curious, as when you looked at best practices, has any city figured out how to do land trusts on a large enough scale that you can actually preserve a neighborhood that's fighting gentrification, that's fighting development seeping into their neighborhood and pushing people out?
Yeah, I think there's definitely several. I think the city of Austin, Texas, has a great land trust model that a lot of people are modeling theirs after. Large scale is a relative term, but certainly they're attacking it on a neighborhood-by-neighborhood basis. addressing gentrification and mitigating the risk of displacement for those residents. So there are communities that are addressing it on a large scale.
So that's Chris Kizzy of Enterprise Community Advisors. He's the consultant that Julie Iseult, City Council member Julie Iseult, was talking to. Has the city considered investing in a land trust?
We are having those conversations. But also, I think we need to change that conversation about affordable housing. Because affordable is such a subjective word. Because what's affordable to me very well is not the same thing that's considered affordable for my colleague, Mr. Drigg. So if we look at truly diverse price point housing, I think that helps to change the conversation. Because also, for whatever reason, workforce and affordable has such a negative connotation to it that really is unfair to those who are working. If you think about it, as a council member, part-time, I do this job full-time, I fall in that category. And classify, I wouldn't have my home today if I tried to purchase, when we look at the fact that salaries and wages have stagnated around that 53-56. But your Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee are having conversations about how do we create a trust, who will be in charge of it, is that something the city will hold, will we work with a nonprofit, say Foundation for the Carolinas, how would the community get access to it, or should it be community-led?
We talked a couple of weeks ago on this program to several gentlemen who are trying to start a land trust in on the west side,
yes,
in West Charlotte. Will they be coming to you to invest in that land trust? Will the city council get involved with them?
The only way we'll be able to even have the conversation is if they approach the city. It is one of my neighborhoods. We've been having conversations to try to figure out what that looks like. But for city council, specifically the Housing and Neighborhood Development, I do not go out and make any commitments for our council. We bring it to committee so the committee can have a full discussion. And then from committee, we make a decision to move it forward to full council for it to be voted on.
You made an interesting point a second ago about not calling it necessarily affordable or workforce housing because those terms have negative connotations, and you wanted to call it
diverse price point housing.
Diverse price point housing, and it's because a lot of people don't make a lot of money.
Exactly.
There have always been poor people, and they struggled to find housing. They've struggled to feed themselves. They've struggled to clothe their children, etc. They've always been that. Is it worse today? I mean, we talk about wage stagnation, and a lot of things in private business have been foisted, in my opinion, have been foisted off on the counties and the cities around the country. For instance, where companies used to train their workers, now we do it for them at community colleges. And there's supposedly this maybe you want to jump in here, Eli. So there's supposedly this trade-off that, yes, you're getting our company, and therefore you're getting our workers' tax dollars, and therefore you should train our workers. There is that tax thing, and there's that trade-off there. But if wages stay stagnant and prices continue to rise, and Charlotte's home prices are, and the rent prices are, where's the breaking point? Where's the trade-off? You're essentially trying to fill a hole that private enterprise will not fill.
Well, and that is the tough point, especially with wages, because we've seen home prices since the crater after the recession rising, sometimes close to or even in double digits again. We're back at pre-recession highs for buying a house. We're at record rates with our average apartment rent. If wages were keeping up, I don't think we'd necessarily be having this discussion as often as we're having. Where the disconnect is that people are feeling this because their wages are not keeping up.
Right.
And that leads us back to this question of, what do you do? Do you have people just move farther away, move to Gaston County where housing and rent is much cheaper and commute in every day? There are plenty of people who say that's the solution and we should just let that happen naturally. But I think that is
– but isn't that how the suburbs got built?
Yes.
People wanted their house in the suburbs and that wasn't going to happen close in. So they went and they got – the land was cheaper, therefore the housing was cheaper, and they were willing to, that was the trade-off they were willing to make.
Right, and that's still the trade-off that the majority of people make. If you look at how the population's broken out over urban versus suburban, despite mm-hmm. the regrowth of cities, the majority of people are still living in the suburbs and exurbs.
Ed.
I wanted to say in defense of private enterprise that world markets have lowered the cost of labor.
Right.
For a period, we saw a huge outflow of American jobs to countries where it was cheaper. Those jobs are coming back because American employers have found a way to be competitive producing in the United States. But what that has done is it's squeezed benefits, and it's made it harder for them to do a lot of the things they used to do for their employees. And you have to choose between having the jobs here and not having the jobs here. But there's no kind of easy alternative for them because their foreign competitors will eat them alive if they try to do all the things they used to do.
And I would say the other piece of that is our educational system. All of us that are sitting in this room right now represent different ages. But when I was in middle school, we actually had training. So I came out of school with certain skills. I knew how to type. I had gone through woodworking and workshop. When I came out at 17, 18 years old, I was able to go right into the workforce. So there's a difference.
We're not doing that today?
For a lot of our young people, no. Today, when you look at it, there's tech, there's technology for those who are in a school where that's an option and availability to them. But as my colleague mentioned earlier, if you are in a lower income community and now you have community schools, that school has substandard opportunities versus another school where the neighborhood is much more wealthy.
So if I understand this correctly, at yesterday's meeting, one of the things that came out of it was, yes, we have a crisis with affordable housing, but workforce housing, there seems to be a surplus. Was that one of the things that came out of yesterday's meeting that was a surprise to a lot of people?
I didn't hear surplus. We have a lot more availability in the workforce, but there's also that challenge where even when we look at the aging housing that's becoming affordable, we have hedge funds coming into our community that are buying those units, rehabbing them. So we actually threw out the conversation yesterday. I asked for staff to look at some of our older projects where we had 30 years of affordability on it and we had 30 years of keeping diverse price points in there. Can we start having conversations with them now to look at possibly investing in some of the rehab in order to keep it accessible to the broader community?
I wanted to say that 75% of the units that we're going to create with this initiative are actually at the 60% and below price point. The notion of a surplus came from the count of the consultants that said there were 50,000 more units of supply in the 50 to 80 and above than there was demand, and 22,000 less of supply in the 50 and below range. So that's where that came from. But as I pointed out before, a lot of that is not deed restricted, and therefore you're not guaranteed that it will continue to be available. We have targeted, we focused, however, with our new investments in the 60 and below AMI.
And I think that shows that a lot of what we're talking about where things are located, you know, these naturally affordable units, lower priced units, they exist. There are places you can rent for $800, $900, $1,000 that are technically affordable to someone who's making the $45,000 salary. Mm-hmm. They might be very far away from downtown where a lot of jobs are, but they exist. Where they don't exist nearly as much and where you see people who are being forced to double up, sleep on couches, move very frequently, that's in the very low income range. Mm. And that's where you know, the units just don't exist in enough numbers.
And the mayor, along with other people, have called the lack of affordable housing a crisis in Charlotte. From what you know from your reporting, is that an accurate way to describe it?
Well, I think that it is a big problem, but many people don't see it as a crisis because in some ways it is a somewhat invisible crisis.
Right.
If you have people who are homeless in large numbers in tent encampments downtown. I was in San Diego a few months ago and saw that there. There's a lot of talk in their local media about a homelessness crisis. It's very in your face. It's in the tourist districts. You see it. Here, there's not a sign you wear on your head if you're spending 60% of your income on your housing. There's not a sign you wear around that says, I'm staying on my aunt's couch for 6 months because I can't find a place to stay.
Right.
So the people who are affected by this are not, in our faces all the time. And in a lot of ways, that makes it a somewhat invisible problem if you're not paying attention.
As of December of last year, I read that the average rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Charlotte was $1,468 a month. Mm-hmm. That's the average rent. What do you get for $1,468 a month? This is one of those new units that they're 10,000 units they're putting up, these so-called luxury apartments that they're going up. Is that what that is?
That would definitely be a higher end
new unit.
You
can buy a house
unit.
For that. That's
well,
a mortgage
if you can get the down payment together.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are still a lot of older units that are, you know, less than that. We ran a story recently.
What are they like?
Well, I think it varies a lot. But we ran a story recently by my colleague Fred Kelly this weekend about people who are staying in shelters, long-term shelters. They're motels and hotels defined as transitional housing. They're paying $1,000 a month, and they're living in a vermin-infested environment. They could spend that and live in a decent two-bedroom apartment, say, down Monroe Road, but they have other barriers. They have credit problems. They have background check problems. Some of them have substance abuse problems. And this discussion that we're having now really illustrates why housing doesn't have a silver bullet, because as soon as you start talking about what people can afford, you get into talking about wages, what kind of jobs there are. You get into talking about schools, education. Do they have the job skills? And you get into, do they have barriers such as a criminal history or bad credit that prevent them from accessing the housing market? So really, it's a discussion that touches everything, and that's why it's such a knotty problem to solve.
Just wanted to make 2 points quickly. For one, Charlotte is suffering from a very high growth rate, which is actually in many respects a high-grade problem, but we're experiencing common issues of urbanization. You can see it everywhere around the country. We have done a pretty good job of providing shelter for people who are literally homeless on the streets, but there is a lot of homelessness involved in sleeping on couches and things like that that we haven't addressed. I think crisis is a very severe term to apply to it, but it's a priority issue for council that we're trying to address.
And as we've said, although you're slightly ahead of the game in terms of your goal that you set for yourselves last year, the need is great and growing quickly because people are moving here. And as they move here, both those who have the money to buy or rent affordable, more than affordable housing, are forcing people out of low-income areas as gentrification occurs, and then that even increases the need for affordable housing. And at your meeting yesterday, resident Angela Ambroise told the city council that she's concerned some of the strategies won't solve the problem fast enough.
And we need to look at opportunities that we can grab right now. I am confused when I hear that CMS has three buildings for sale in highly displacement areas. We're talking Wilmore, we're talking Cherry and Druid Hills. That is a tangible thing that you can do now to move to purchase those buildings to provide affordable housing.
Can you convert a school? Can you buy a school building and convert it?
So what I will say is we've already started the conversations with both CMS as well as the Mecklenburg County Board of County Commissioners to talk about land and buildings they own. We seem to forget that the county received the ability through legislation a number of years ago where they also have the ability to develop true mixed income housing. So we're trying to partner with them. They need to come to the table in all honesty so that because we have some land and we have some opportunities.
Luana Mayfield is the chair of the Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee for Charlotte City Council. Ed Driggs is the vice chair. Eli Portillo reports for the Charlotte Observer. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Duke Energy, committed to building a smarter energy future for the Carolinas. More at duke-energy.com/future. On Point, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, guest host Sasha Pfeiffer is in for Tom Ashbrook for a conversation about how the devastating floods in Texas put the spotlight back on the nation's troubled flood insurance program. That's coming up in 20 minutes. And coming up on September 20th, we have a public conversation on how Charlotte's doing 1 year after the Keith Scott shooting. That'll be at the McGlowan Theater. You're invited, but you have to get more information about it and register, I believe, at WFAE.org. Well, you could do that right now. And we're coming right back.
We can learn so much information so quickly that there's just one question. What does it all mean?
9 senators rejected that Senate version of the bill.
Venezuela was paralyzed by strikes and protests.
This missile can actually travel much farther.
Morning Edition slows the news down, takes a second look, works to understand not just what's happening, but why. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
We're 90.7 WFAE, your source for in-depth news.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about affordable housing, the need for it in Charlotte, and City Council's Economic Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee meeting yesterday, in which they discovered that they're slightly ahead, but the need is great and rising quickly. And we'll talk more about that as we go through the hour with Luana Mayfield and Ed Driggs, both on the committee, the chair and the vice chair, and Eli Portillo from the Charlotte Observer. Let me share with you a couple of things that have come in while we've been talking from people. Gene emails, ironic that tiny houses would solve the problem, but zoning refuses to approve tiny houses. Meanwhile, Emily says, could tiny houses help fill the gap? If a landowner has a big enough lot size, why doesn't the city allow a tiny house? Charlotte could be a leader if council would commit to rethinking minimum housing requirements. The crux of our problem is everybody wants to live close to the city at a reasonable cost. To get there, we need to rethink how we use existing land or unused land to provide the most quality housing at an affordable price. You were shaking your head on the tiny house comment, Luana.
We actually started this conversation a couple of years ago. I met with a number of developers regarding tiny homes, and we were working with our planning department because there's multiple challenges with the idea of a tiny home. You have a community right now that's promoting, I have a concern that they have a $4,000 non-refundable deposit. You don't have a lot of information on them. When you're talking about individual homes, you're talking about sewer, you're talking about sanitation. We have to think about what does pickup. We had a major discussion within the last 2 years about trash pickup at multifamily. There's a lot of pieces to that particular puzzle. But also when we approve accessory dwellings, what we saw more often were people who had those larger lots. It wasn't as if those in the community that are in that 30% or the 50% and below were the ones who were getting access. They were basically building an additional home that they turned into a B&B through an online site or for a family member, not necessarily a senior, to keep their parents at the home so that they can age in place, but just as a rental unit.
Right.
So then you have that conversation. If you're starting a business, how does the city track and tax for that?
So Kelly on Facebook writes, government has to have a role in affordable housing because the developers are only going to do what is going to make them the most money. We'll talk more about developers in a second, because the city has very little leverage. Well, let's talk about it now. The city has very little leverage with developers. You've put out incentives. Not many developers have taken you up on the offer to include in their new construction affordable housing units. And you can't make them do it because the state won't let you do that. What really can you do besides say, this would be great if you did it?
The developers are business people, and they participate in our free enterprise economy, which works for us very well in most areas. So no, we can't impose a tax on them by requiring them to do things that are not profitable in the public interest. It's up to us to fund projects like that. But we have had great conversations with developers about partnerships in which a portion of new developments are set aside for affordable housing, or in which through different funding structures we can make it
But are they losing money? Because affordable housing units, I read this, I think it might be one of your articles, Eli, that affordable housing units run around $800 a month to rent. And builders say it is impossible to build those units to rent at that price and make money. They cost more than that to build. Much of the cost is in labor to actually construct the unit. But they also point an accusing finger at the permit process. If those permit fees were waived or reduced, would that enable builders to bring projects in so they could be rented at something closer to $800 a month versus $1,100 or $1,400 a month?
I think it's an overstatement to suggest that the permit process has that big an impact on the rents. So that's a little bit of a misrepresentation. We do have barriers, however, procedural barriers, bureaucratic barriers that we could work on. We could facilitate the construction by relaxing some of the requirements that we would normally apply to for-profit things. That's a non-financial way, one of the many tools available to us that we discussed at our meeting. I get back to the same thing, though. There's a cost associated with anything you do. And one of my responsibilities, I feel, is to look at it from a budgetary standpoint and say, what's the most effective use of taxpayer dollars?
I think that the process by which developers sometimes agree to voluntarily include affordable housing units, those are generally the workforce units. They're meant for people, reserved for people making 80% or so of the median income. Mm-hmm. And what the study that we saw yesterday really highlighted for me was that that might not be addressing the area of most pressing concern. You know, it might not be a bad thing to include workforce units in some of the new projects that are around here. For example, the Brooklyn Village redevelopment that is planned in partnership with the county for a lot of Second Ward. That includes, I believe, roughly 100 units that will be reserved for people making 80% or so of the median income. But that is the area where the study last night said there's not that pressing need. It's for the 30% or lower, and that's not generally addressed in these kind of agreements.
Yeah, many have said that the real need is for 30,000. This number may be low, 30,000 affordable housing units. And if you were to achieve your goal of 5,000 affordable housing units in 3 years, will we ever catch up?
It's still going to be 30,000. Let's have a real conversation. As you mentioned, people are moving to Charlotte every day. Depending on who you talk to, that number is 44 to 48. A lot of these people are moving here without family, without a job, looking for an opportunity. We definitely need to have real conversations about that 50% and below, and how do we get more of those units out of the ground. But I have a challenge when developers say, well, if you just give us more money, then we'll build, because it's not even the conversation of a communal good. Economically, the business sense is there to create truly diverse price point housing when you think about the opportunity. So even though we are moving forward, we also have to recognize that, are we utilizing the opportunity with Habitat for Humanity? Habitat for Humanity has shown the model. Their goal is actual home ownership and not to put everybody in an apartment.
Why is it in the business community's best interest to have mixed affordable housing mixed in? Why?
So the reason that there's multiple reasons, but one of the many reasons is your workforce. Do you want your workforce 3-4 hours outside of where you're located and risk the chance, and if they're on public transportation, risk the chance of them not being able to get to work on time or having to leave at a certain time in order to get back, pick up their families if they have children, opposed to having a truly diverse community where, one, their child has access to a daycare that's affordable. You're paying them good money. They're living in quality housing, and they're not listening to gunshots going off at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning or constantly worried about whether or not they're going to have a roof over their head and still be able to buy groceries and be healthy employees.
I think I should mention there are also federal programs. The city administers about $8 million a year in federal money for housing that's aimed at the lowest brackets. The federal government funds 30% and below housing. That's through the Charlotte Housing Authority. So there is a diversity of programs. We have traditionally been more focused on that mid to upper affordable housing. But now we're asking ourselves whether, in light of the Economic Opportunity Task Force findings and other things, we should pay more attention down lower as well.
Task Force finding,
yes,
it said that we were 50th. In the top 50 cities, we're the 50th in upward mobility.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that concerns everybody in the city. And you wanted to say something else. I just wanted to point that out. That's all.
Well, I think that's worth emphasizing, because I think everybody was a bit shocked to learn that.
Yeah.
I think the feeling we have about Charlotte is that this is sort of a happy and harmonious place. And we have had a number of shocks in the last couple of years in terms of the unrest we experienced, the findings of the task force, and so on. But as I look at these problems, what I'm trying to do is find the most efficient way to deploy city resources, because they are scarce. We're not going to build 30,000 units. It would cost about $150 million to completely solve this problem. How can you get the best relief from the most acute situations with the means that we have available?
And know that government has a limited role. So to the best of our ability, how do we come in and be a part of the conversation? But it's not up to government to have the total solutions. It is a joint conversation that has to happen within the nonprofit community, all the churches that have land and have access to land. We need them to come to the table so that we can start having some real conversations about how do we impact our residents.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the program, Eli, and I think you reported this, the city's affordable housing fund is running low on money. A month ago, I think they had a roughly, is that right, a month ago, the city's housing trust fund had a surplus of roughly $20 million. That sounds like a lot to me. Why is it in jeopardy of being used up? Where does it stand today?
Well, that's a good reason, though.
I wouldn't say it's in jeopardy of being used up or running dry in that sense. Mm-hmm. The city and city council are making a decision to deploy that money and spend it on these 700 and some housing units in five different projects that Luana mentioned a little while ago.
And that fund is fed by bond money?
So that fund is fed by bond money that's approved by voters every 2 years.
Okay.
And that's at $15 million every 2 years.
And the Charlotte Opportunity Task Force has recommended that that bond fund needs to be increased from $15 million every 2 years to $50 million. Is that feasible?
Mike, I wanted to say, for one, the accumulation of funds in there was because of the model we were using, which was to try to deploy those funds in conjunction with a 9% incentive program that's offered by the federal government through the state. The reason we're able now to deploy the funds is we've gone to a different model, which is a 4% program, involves a slightly higher investment of city money, but it's accessible readily. We can deploy the funds quickly. I don't believe $50 million is the right number. Personally, I could see an increase.
Too high?
Too high, yes. Mm-hmm. I think my own view is that we could step up from the 15 that we have been putting in every 2 years, maybe to a number like 25. But again, we have to be accountable to taxpayers as well. And when you start to divert $50 million to this one need.
I say 30.
But if you know the need is dire, mm-hmm. If you're limited, you have limited tools in your toolkit to make people do things. You can't make them do anything. So it has to come from altruism on the part of developers and homeowners and people who own apartment buildings, or it has to come from dollars that you're saying, no, that's not right?
I don't think you have those hard choices. I think there are other ways that you can address these issues, for example, by streamlining permitting process and stuff like that, by looking at the way we do the area restrictions we impose.
But if the need has already outstripped the available resources, and it's going to get worse as home prices rise and more people move here and rents become higher and gentrification continues, aren't you just spitting into the wind?
So yes or no. So when I said $30 million, our bond capacity is that. And I think we should go to the community and today start the conversation. Community, we're going to be coming to you next year in November for a bond package. We're going to be asking you for $30 million, hopefully, because that's the number that will help us move forward. But if we do it right and utilizing Austin, utilizing best practices, if that means we need to get a developer from outside mm-hmm. that has successfully created and developed true diverse price point housing that's going to hit that 50 and below, that 30 to 50 category, then we need to utilize that. That's why I said with Habitat for Humanity, we're having a conversation about them expanding and would a revolving trust fund, because we're having multiple conversations. What would a revolving trust fund look like for the city to house in order to have access to those funds for those groups that are actually really focused on rehabbing an apartment complex or building new with our target in mind?
We can make a difference, and we send a message to the community that we care with these investments. It would be unreasonable to try to completely solve the problem and fund 30,000 units.
You suggested it in the past that the city would could create an entirely new program, one that might, for instance, include rental subsidies for low-income residents. Was that discussed yesterday, and where would the money for those subsidies come from?
That actually came up in the context of a suggestion I made that we fund a project at Bojangles Coliseum with tourism dollars,
exactly.
Free up some money from the community investment plan for our housing so that we make a more meaningful investment. Again, sending a message to the community that we're serious and that we care. And I think what we did yesterday also sends that message. What I was talking about in general was being a little more creative. We have worked in a couple of narrow channels. We've created obstacles to our own goals in terms of location policy, for example, prescribing where the affordable housing has to go, which directs it to places where the land prices are so high that it's not economic to put it there. So there are things that we can do to make the environment friendlier.
So if I understand your proposal, you would give rent subsidies to people, which means you'd give them if the apartment costs $1,000 a month and they can only afford X, you give them the difference between X and 1,000. Is that what you're saying essentially here?
What I'm trying to do is crystallize as an economist the cost
so
one way or another
of
what we're doing.
So is that cheaper than building and rehabbing and encouraging developers? Is it just cheaper to give a chunk of change to somebody like a check?
It's a combination. Remember, we're looking at multiple opportunities here. So I was at a meeting last Tuesday that was coordinated at the McCall Center by the group Gender Lines, where we specifically talked about access to housing. There are vouchers out there today. The problem is we don't have the units, or we don't have the owner of the apartment complex or the owner of that home that would accept the voucher.
Right.
So we have vouchers now. What we're trying to say is if we were to expand the voucher program. You, owner of this apartment complex, what is the time limit that you need to receive the difference of those funds? Because it's usually a 30, 45-day lag. But I know you receive your bonuses at the end of the year based on you getting your on-time payments. So that means that manager of that apartment complex isn't necessarily going to be the biggest champion for vouchers, because that's going to affect their bottom line. So can we streamline that process if we were to go that route? So we have vouchers. We don't have enough housing that will fall in that category for people to utilize the vouchers, or where they would recognize that these are individuals, these are people. Give them an opportunity to have access to quality housing.
But before we go, we have 10 seconds here. Are we making progress?
Yes.
We are.
We are making progress.
I think we made a meaningful move yesterday. Yes.
I think the city's making moves and progress, but in a lot of ways it's a math problem. We've got people pouring in here and not as much supply.
Eli Portillo from the Charlotte Observer, Ed Driggs and Luana Mayfield, Vice Chair and Chair, respectively, of the Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee for Charlotte City Council. Thanks for the